Hello and welcome to Gary Has Issues. I'm Gary, and I traditionally do have issues. I'm with Ken Seisler in Los Angeles. And Ken, you have issues, but you also have
a lot of
issues.
Yes, her name is Deborah.
All right, very good. Today, I'm going to call this a very special broadcast because I don't have an issue per se. In fact, my only issue is the fact that I'm delighted with the fact that our guest is someone very special, great friend of Ken's, and someone that I've known for years. Now, before I say his name, I brought him up to my wife, no idea who he was. To my son, who's an aspiring actor, no idea who he was. Went over to the neighbor, said, I'm having so-and-so on the show. No idea who he was.
It's a great introduction, Gap.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
But then I brought up, shut up, both of you. I brought up what he's done, what he's produced, what he has brought into American culture. Oh, a little film called Speed, for example, with Keanu Reeves. The Patriot with that crazy guy. A film called Saving Private Ryan. And that's just some of his film work. How about in television, Grey's Anatomy? My wife started getting very excited, asking about Patrick Dempsey, blah, blah, blah. Criminal Minds, Ray Donovan. Obviously, some very seminal work. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Gordon.
That was very kind.
So I want to go back to the fact that not many people know Mark Gordon, even though he's produced these iconic films and culture-changing TV shows.
Seminal films and television shows.
They may recognize, for bad reasons, Harvey Weinstein, but they'll know Jerry Bruckheimer. They'll know Scott Rudin. They'll know Brian Grayden. They'll know a lot of those people's names. And so the fact is, you have your movies and your TV shows are incredibly high profile, but you're not.
Right, right.
So that's the answer to that question. Thank you, Mark.
Well, that's fine. You know, first of all, let me just say this. Some people go for the publicity. I'm interested in the cash. So that's really how it breaks down. Actually, that's not true, but it sounded like it might be humorous, so
right.
I said it anyway. I'm going to not take this call.
Okay.
Look, here's the thing. I believe that the work needs to speak for itself. It's not about me. And the fact is that very few producers are well known. There are some of the ones that you've talked about that have been very successful and have an enormous amount of publicity attached to them. That's not of interest to me. What's interesting to me is the work. So you're rarely going to see me at a premiere. You're rarely going to see me at a party. You're rarely going to see me with my arm around a celebrity. It's just not the part of the business that interests me. I'm not a particularly controversial guy. Some of the people that you mentioned, their celebrity is based on their controversy. And some of them, by the way, are because, though I have been quite successful, some of the other people that you mentioned are wildly successful. Jerry Bruckheimer is rich and famous because of all the CSIs that we've seen on the air. And you keep seeing his name. You know, I had Criminal Minds. That was one show. I think there were three or four CSIs. And also Jerry Bruckheimer has made a slew of hugely high profile movies. And the kind of films that he makes, they are Jerry Bruckheimer movies more than they are anything else. My movies, I don't really think that there's an identification where there's a Mark Gordon movie. And that's because of the kind of movies that I choose to make, which are very eclectic. So there might be a small movie like Molly's Game, and then there might be a little movie that we made for $6 million called The Messenger that only cost $6 million. And then there's Day After Tomorrow, and those are Roland Emmerich movies. And then there's, you know, Saving Private Ryan, and that's a Steven Spielberg movie. So interestingly enough, and certainly they made different kinds of movies, but if you think of a great producer like David O. Selznick, most people won't be able to tell you who the director of Gone with the Wind was. Mm. but they'll be able to tell you who the producer was. He was that kind of producer. And oddly, Jerry Bruckheimer is in many ways David O. Selznick in that those are producerial movies. I just pick interesting material, and there's a broad range. Now I'm repeating myself, but I think you understand.
Yeah, right.
And also, I don't ask. I'm not interested in getting my name in the paper, other than to advance my business opportunities. And I'm not saying that these people are, but it's, you know, we have different kinds of careers. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the fact that you, because I want to define what a producer is for people out there. And especially because you were the president of the Producers Guild of America.
Right.
And as president of the Producers Guild in America, you made substantial changes in defining what the role of the producer is.
And that little PGA seal of approval, right?
That's Mark.
That is something that my co-president, fellow president, Hawk Koch, and I spent years while we were presidents of the Guild pushing forward. You know, the interesting thing about a producer is that there are so many different kinds of producers. Producers do different things in television than they do in movies. They're line producers who are basically responsible for the physical production, which means the day-to-day managing of the financial and production aspects of the movie. There are producers who are really great packagers and put things together and are not good with the physical production or maybe even the creative part of developing and producing movies. I think
what do you answer to the question when people probably say, oh, what do you do for a living? And you say, I'm a producer. Often do they go, what does a producer do?
The answer that I give is that I am responsible from the beginning to the end, generally, for everything that you see on the screen from the beginning of the process. The producer is usually the first one in and the last one out the door. The producer will create or work with a writer to create.
But this is specifically movies.
Story. Well, movies and television, both. It depends.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I mean, it depends. But if you want to get a single answer, it's who is it that's responsible for creative, financial, marketing of a movie and or television show from the beginning to end. Now, in television, there are executive producers who are creators, they're showrunners, they're writers. It's very complicated in television because what is normally seen as a producerial responsibility in television, you've got writers taking producer credits. And the reason the writers take producer credits is because television is, even more so than movies, a collaborative process. So one producer may be spending time in the editing room. Another producer may be standing on the set. The writer of that episode may be the producer of that episode. They may be running the room. They may be doing all different kinds of things. And if you ask on a television show, the showrunner will say, we are a team of producers. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of writers, not to be controversial, they will get a producer credit so they don't have to pay them more money. And you automatically go up the chain of, you know, story editor to consulting producer to co-producer to co-executive producer to producer to executive producer. And usually those are basically how long have you been in the game and how long have you been doing it, as opposed to whether you're really hands-on producing the movie.
In television, it's more of psychic reward, right? It makes people feel better to get a producer.
Yeah, and some of these
films, right? Which was true in films.
Which is why
you came up with the PGA designation.
Which is, yes, but in film, it's a little easier because in film, it certainly didn't used to take an army of people to make movies. When independent films started coming into vogue and people were getting their movies financed outside the studio system, which is a fairly black and white process, you had financiers who were coming in. They wanted to produce by credit. You had managers of actors. They wanted to produce by credit. You had a lot of people who wanted to take a produced by credit. Why? Because it's the better credit, and because the Academy Awards only give the award to the producer, meaning produced by, as opposed to executive producer. And so the fact of the matter is that the producer in film, they have to be the person that actually produced the movie. And if you didn't produce the movie, take an executive producer credit. And that's what we tried in the Producers Guild to make people understand. And it took years to get the studio to recognize the fact that you don't have multiple people who helped the DP take the DP credit. You don't have a gaffer who lit the film and who supervised the lighting. They're best boys, and there's a best boy. He's the number two, and then there are electricians, and then there are grips. The guy who's the prop master has an assistant prop master, but not everybody takes the prop master credit. So it's a legitimate credit. I will say that many people don't know how to produce a movie who get a producer credit. If you've got $50 and you option a script, you can be a producer. Any schmuck can call himself a producer, and that's why it's such a great.
And if any schmuck would know that, you would be the one. Mark.
I'm the schmuck who knows.
I just want to ask something, because I think the PGA designation is the good housekeeping seal of approval for the audience as well, so that when people watch a movie and they see the little PGA, they know that that person actually was that, did those work.
Yeah.
But my question is, can somebody take a producer credit?
Yeah.
And oh, they still can, and not get the PGA designation, or the only. So that,
yeah,
you can literally have somebody on screen that you'll have two producers, and one producer will get the PGA, and the other producer will not.
Yes, recently I finished a big budget studio picture. It was a sequel to a movie that I made. The first film I took a producer credit because I found the material, found the writer, sold it to the studio, found the director, hired the actors. I really did supervise and do my job. On the second picture, I had very little to do with it. It was the same director. He had a producing partner. She was producing the movie day to day. And I really wasn't involved. And I went to the other producers of the movie, a few of whom were doing as little or less work than I was. And I said, hey, take an executive producer credit with me. We didn't produce the movie. And even if you try, you're not going to get the PGA mark because you don't qualify. You didn't produce the movie. One of the producing partners of mine agreed to take an executive producer credit with me. And two of them chose to take the producer credit without getting the PGA mark. And I argued that, why don't you take an executive producer credit and set a good example? Because it's the truth. Don't take credit when you don't deserve it. So some people have an ethical, moral approach to these kinds of things. And some people just want the produced by credit because it's the higher level credit, even if they don't get the PGA mark.
But if you get an Oscar, can you receive the Oscar with the producer credit, but not with the PGA designation?
No.
So you have to have the PGA in order to get up on stage and take the award.
Almost always. Now, the Producers Guild vets the credits, and that information goes over to the Motion Picture Academy when it's time to consider people for Academy Awards. There have been, in rare circumstances, times when the Motion Picture Academy has reversed the decision of the Producers Guild. It's happened maybe twice in the last 10 years, and so rarely, if ever, happens. But the fact is that though the Motion Picture Academy relies on the Producers Guild to do that vetting, because it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of movies every year. When it comes down to Academy Awards, it's not a pure rubber stamp. They have the right to change it if they so desire. But for the most part, that's correct.
Mark, let me ask you a question. So how do you attach yourself, how do you find a project like Speed? Does a script come across your desk and you say, okay, it's a story of a bus that can't go over 55 miles an hour? How do you say, this is what I'm going to get behind and develop? How does this start? How do you find a project?
You know, it's always different. In the case of Speed, it was a script that went out. It was a spec script. So the writer wrote it on his own without being paid to write it and owned it. It went out to a number of different producers, myself included. I read the script and I thought it was really interesting. And I said, we would like to be a part of this. I was given the script for Paramount. So it still works this way where occasionally a spec script will come out. And if you have a relationship at Paramount, you might get it for Paramount. This guy might get it for Warner Brothers, because the conventional wisdom is that if you have a deal at that studio, Warner Brothers, Paramount, there's no longer a Fox, but Disney, MGM, Sony, whatever, you have a better chance of convincing that studio to buy the script because you have a special relationship with them. I had a deal at Paramount. Did I have a deal at Paramount at the time? No, I don't think
there was that deal at Paramount where they were trying to get you out of your office. I remember that deal.
We're gonna circle back to that story because that story more changed than my life.
I've been thrown out a better place than Paramount.
We're going back.
But in that case, I read the script. I really liked it. I gave it to Paramount. Just so happened that nobody else was interested in it. Paramount bought it. It took forever to get the deal done. Don't ask me why. Like 9 months. We developed the script at Paramount. They ultimately decided not to make it. They gave it back to me. I took it to 20th Century Fox, and they decided they wanted to make the movie. But every film is different. Saving Private Ryan was an original idea of Bob Rodat's, and he brought me a true story, and we adapted it into...
Well, before you go into all of this stuff, because yeah. This is what I think, because you have so many credits and so many movies to talk about.
Yeah.
I thought I would do, I'm going to call it a Rorschach test.
You want me to just like whatever comes into my mind?
I am going to say the name of the movie.
Like, you know, you could say something and I could go asshole. Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. All right, let's start. We're going to do it by year. We're going to do it by year.
Yeah, okay.
Your first feature, and correct me if I'm wrong, Opportunity Knocks.
Yes, sir. I clearly have not had a lot of success in comedy. So maybe I should just leave it at that. I thought I was funny, and maybe some of the people listening to this will think so, but I haven't been able to translate to that screen. I think I'm stuck on Preston Sturges and Howard Hawks, and I'm not like a current comedy guy.
But Opportunity Knocks was an opportunity knocking for you.
That was Dana Carvey.
Really did. That, yes, it was Dana Carvey. That movie that made you a film producer.
My first studio picture, yes.
And so that got you. So the reaction to that was, okay, he can make a movie.
We trust him to make a movie, even if it's a flop. At least he knows.
Speaking of flops,
yes.
Swing Kids.
Well, Swing Kids, you know, was heartbreaking. Actually, I loved that project. I loved what it was about.
Did you know what it was about, Gary? Have you heard of that movie, Swing Kids?
I probably. I don't remember it. I could have said that Christian Bale was in it. I remember that. What it,
yes. Was.
Kenneth Branagh.
Ken Branagh
yes.
was
yes.
Barbara Hershey.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful cast. But the movie.
Tell the premise for those who don't know.
True events in Hamburg, Germany, and throughout Germany, but primarily in Hamburg, there were a group of kids who were fanatical jazz aficionados. Benny Goodman, Big Spiderbeck, Louis Armstrong, yeah. Big band, swing. And they had long hair, and they wore these kind of funny British clothes, and they were almost like, you know, the hippies of days gone by, and in terms of the way they dressed. And this was right around the time that Hitler was coming to power, and there was the Hitler Youth. And there was a real antagonism.
And you said you didn't do comedy.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
trust me, the reviews were the same as where you're heading. But they were.
But your cast was amazing.
Great cast, and I thought it was a fairly good movie. I didn't love it, but I thought it was good, and I thought it was worthy.
Off of Swing Kids, off of that, which was a flop.
Thank you.
Speed was your next movie after that. This is your life, Mark Gordon.
Yeah.
Mark, if I have behind you.
And Keanu, we're going off the game here, but Keanu Reeves, he was great, but I never would have connected if I saw that script. Oh, Keanu Reeves is the right action star for this.
Well, we didn't either. It's interesting. Keanu was, he wasn't a movie star. He was a celebrity. He had been in a couple of films. He was in Bill and Ted's,
right,
which was obviously a very different tone. and he was also in Point Break, which was a little more the tone of Speed. But he wasn't a big star. And of course, what happens in a movie is that most of the time, and this was a fairly inexpensive film. I think the movie cost about $26 million at the time. But that wasn't cheap. It wasn't like a $6 million, $8 million. I think Opportunity Knocks budget was 10.
Could you imagine what Speed would cost today?
Well, yeah, it would cost a lot. But if it had been the same director and me, it would have cost less than it would have cost if a bigger director had done it even now.
Right.
But the point is, we went out to a few movie star types. Bruce Willis, oddly enough at the time, Billy Baldwin, who was bigger star. And they turned us down. And I was able to get the studio to bring their expectation down about who would be right for it. And the interesting thing about the character was that he was not a verbose. It wasn't about the dialogue. It was about the presence of this character. And Keanu had the presence, and we didn't know.
Did you screen test him?
No, we didn't test him. He was too big for a test, but not big enough to go slam dunk movie star.
What about Sandra Bullock?
Sandy Bullock, we tested a number of times because we couldn't get our first choice, Halle Berry.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it would have been a good choice, but boy, it was Sandra Bullock a knock out of the park.
Sandy was just so funny and charming, but she had done virtually nothing. The only real credit that she had was in a Joel Silver picture called Demolition Man?
Demolition Man.
Yep. And she was kind of funny and charming in that movie. She just came in and auditioned. It wasn't even like, oh, let's offer it to Sandy and test her. She came in with, like a lot of other women did, to test for the part, and she was just so great. And so we had Keanu, who was a celebrity, not a giant star. We had Sandy. And then we had already started shooting when Dennis Hopper's name came up. And we had gone through 40 names of people that we either offered it to and said no, or that the studio, on the one hand, couldn't agree with me and Jan de Bont, the director. And so we were like, oh, we don't like that guy. Oh, you don't like this guy. Oh, we don't like this guy. You don't like that guy. We were shooting in 3 days. It's like, well, we got to fucking get somebody here. And so that was Dennis. And I was worried that, is Dennis too big? Is Dennis too broad? Is he kind of little cartoony?
He was so
Dennis
focused.
At that time, he was sober, but he was still, Dennis Hopper was kind of a cartoon character at that point. And I must tell you that even after seeing the first cut of the movie, Dennis was so big and so broad. And I said, is this going to work? I thought it was fun, but I was worried that is he in a different movie? Is he too over the top? And the answer was, yes, he was, but the audience loved it.
Yeah.
And so you just never know. I mean, I would
tell because you. You look at that movie and you go, how could it be anybody else but those people?
Of course. But I will tell you that if people are honest, mostly it's happenstance. I cannot tell you that any of the success of that movie was by design. The same with the director. Nobody would touch the damn movie with a 10-foot pole. And Jan de Bont, who had never directed a movie before, but who was this brilliant cameraman, I took him into the studio, and the first meeting that he had with them, he blew it. He was nervous. English was not his first language. He was kind of stuttering all over the place. And I got a call after the first meeting from the studio saying, well, that guy's not directing the movie. I said, no. We're not hiring an actor. We're hiring a director. He didn't have a good meeting, but that doesn't mean he's not the right guy. So I literally brought him in and said, Jan, we're going to do like a role playing here. I'm going to be the studio executive and you're going to be you. And we got to prepare for this because you sucked in that meeting and it matters. You got to be something. So we did it. I basically trained him to be good in a room because he wasn't used to that. It's not
when your instincts,
that's what a producer does.
Well, that's right. When your instincts feel that he's the right director, it's the right script, it's the right actor, you really go to bat for them. You really must have a vision.
You have to do that. And sometimes, as I have been in the past, you can be terribly wrong. And you can take a great piece of material and destroy it by hiring the wrong director. And I've done that multiple times, I will tell you.
Perhaps it'll be on my list.
Well, I'm not going to talk about it.
No, I know.
It.
By the way, you can...
Listen, Dennis is dead. I can say whatever the fuck I want to about him. I love him. And he was great in the movie.
Right. I just want you to know that as I go down the list, you can just say pass.
I will.
But Kenny, if you go down this whole list, we'll be here till tomorrow morning.
Well, I the title of this show is Gary Has Issues and Kenny Has Too Much Free
Kenny
Time.
Kenny has nothing but time.
So I'm fine.
Mark's phone is ringing.
Let me get to this. A Pyromania's Love Story.
Pass.
And I know why, but that's a different story.
Don't say anything.
The Hoax, Richard Gere.
I love that movie.
Great movie.
Very proud of that film.
Do you know what that was about, Gary?
I'm sorry, I don't.
That's right. Okay. That's all right. That's
you
all right.
And nobody else.
What did not open at a theater near me?
No, it did. It was a great movie, and somehow it just got lost.
It was.
I remember it came out 2005, 2006.
It's a very hard movie to sell. It was the true story of how Clifford Irving wrote the fake biography of Howard Hughes. I think it's as good a film as Richard Gere has ever done. One of my favorite Lasse Hallström movies, and I've done three movies.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. If you get a chance, it's a fun movie.
Moving on.
Too long, but it's good.
So here now we get into maybe we'll get some juicy stuff out of this one.
Yeah.
Broken Arrow.
I was fired off of that movie.
I didn't know that.
But did
you get producer credit?
Yes, I did. I was asked to leave on the first day of production. They asked
Why?
Me to leave the set. Well, let's just say that I like to get very involved in my films. And I was working with a director.
Who was the director?
John Woo, incredibly talented guy.
Yeah.
Who subsequently I have become friendly with, and we were working on another picture together. It was one of these things where I had just made Speed. This came right after Speed. Graham Yost, who wrote Speed, also wrote this movie. He was also asked to leave too, by the way. We were
really?
Both asked to leave, yes. And I think that a producer's job is to protect the movie, protect the director, and not worry about who you're pissing off, because if you worry about who you're pissing off, you might as well just be a studio executive.
Well, you had told me the story about it was a lunch or a dinner you had with John Travolta.
I did have a lunch with John Travolta where let's get back to that.
Okay.
What I will say is that on the first day of production, I was fighting with the studio. They were doing things that I thought were disrespectful to me and to the director. And I called them on it and they didn't like it. And they got mad and they said, well, why are you? I said, because number one, I'm the producer. I developed the script. I hired the director. Oh, and by the way, not to be an asshole about it, but I also just produced a massive hit for you guys where you made a shitload of money. So maybe you could just give me a little respect and know that if I'm pushing back, it's not to be difficult. It's because this is how I do my job, and I believe in what I'm believing. And Gary, it's what you said. It's like you're not there to suck up, although plenty of producers do. You're there to try and make the best movie. And this is okay, as long as everybody's respectful of each other. But on the first day, I did three things that annoyed, evidently, according to the studio, annoyed the director. One thing happened was that the DP was setting up a shot, and I noticed that the fire, you know, when you're making a fire in a film, you don't use a real fire, you use gas, and you know, it's fake, but it looks real. And I looked at the fire, and we were going to be shooting that in a couple of hours. And I said, I don't think it looks good. You know, I'm doing my advance work for the director. That's what I always do. And the DP said, well, why don't you look through the lens? So I looked through the lens. I said, yeah, I think you need to raise the flame or blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when let's just get it as best we can. And when John gets here, the director, he'll decide. Well, somebody said, oh, what's he looking through the lens for? He's not the director. That's number one. Number two, there was an actor who was again, it was the first day. So we were, once we set the look of these characters. And I thought the guy looked really weird. So I pulled the director over and I said, John, do you like this actor's haircut? He goes, mm-hmm. His English was not great. I said, okay, John likes it. Let's move on. What got back to the studio was that I was meddling in the director's business, and they said, we want you to come home. I said, when? They said, now. And so I was basically thrown off the movie, which was very painful to me.
Can you tell the John Travolta lunch story or no?
We had lunch, and basically what he said was, listen, there are certain things that I would like, certain things that I expect, and if I don't get them, maybe I will be sick one day and won't come out of my trailer, or maybe – basically, he was trying to let me know who was boss.
Who was boss?
And I basically said, yes, boss. At the time, I was trying to get him to do my movie.
All right. I want to keep moving here because I want to get to
the big one. By the way, he was fine.
All right. Paulie, do you want to talk about it? He did a parrot movie.
I mean, does anybody really give a shit?
No, nobody gives a shit. Black dog. So he went from this was Mark's animal era.
Yeah, this was like Picasso's blue period.
Right. This was his animal period.
I have to be honest. I never saw Black Dog.
okay. I didn't either.
We bought the movie in a package of films. We were financing it, and we weren't the producers. So I got an executive producer credit.
Okay. The year is 1997.
Yes.
Richard Rodat. Robert Rodat.
Yes.
Comes into your office, sends you a script. What happens? This is all the setup for Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, I read a script of Bob's. It was a script about, it was a Jekyll and Hyde script. And I really liked the writing, and I called his agent and I said, look, I really like this script. Let's see if we could get this made, which we did years later as a television film. And I said, and I'd really like to meet Bob. I'd like to work with Bob on an original. So Bob came over to my office and we talked a little bit, and I liked him, and he really knew film. And I've got a pretty good, vocabulary of old films and directors. I'm a student. I went to film school. I've seen a lot of movies and I love movies. So I said to Bob, listen, why don't you come over once every week or two? We'll sit for an hour and I'll throw some stuff out at you and you throw some stuff out at me, and let's see if we can find something to do together. Which, by the way, I still work that way with writers. And we had two or three meetings, and we both were like throwing out our crap to each other and nothing stuck. Then one day he came into my office and he said, I read this story in a historical journal. There were four brothers. They were, and it was basically the story that you see. Four brothers, two were killed on the on a ship in the Pacific, and one brother was killed in somewhere else, and the fourth brother was MIA, or they didn't know where he was, somewhere, a couple days after.
Do you know where the original story emanated from?
I was getting to that, but I live in Waterloo, Iowa. It is the home of the five Sullivan brothers.
Right.
And that is what the story is. Now, actuality.
It's actually another story.
Well, it's another story, but I mean, it was the sort of inspiration.
No, it wasn't. It was there were actually four brothers, and I can't remember their names, who were not the Sullivan brothers. And ultimately, we decided to change enough that we needed to fictionalize it. But there were actually four other brothers. They were the Sullivan brothers are the famous brothers who, all
on
died.
On one ship, the Juno.
On one ship. And right. that's why they didn't put everybody in the same.
But that is quoted in the movie, isn't it? Is it not? That sort of policy? Yeah.
Yes, it is. And, the idea was, and this mother's going to get the news and we got to save the fourth brother. He goes, what do you think? I said, I think it's the best idea I've ever heard in my life. It was just sort of like, I can see the movie, I can see the trailer, I can see the poster. And then I'll tell you what I couldn't see, because no one wanted it. We took the pitch out to every studio in town.
Was there a script yet or no, just the pitch?
We just pitched it, because at the time, I wasn't in a position to pay him. And he needed to be paid. He wasn't in a position to write it on spec. So literally every studio passed, and we were like stunned. I thought this was the best thing I had ever seen. And everybody said, we don't want to do a World War II movie and nobody's interested. I said, you're crazy, but okay. So after we got rejected everywhere, I picked up the phone and called an executive at Paramount who we'd pitched it to. I said, look, just pay the guy scale. Could you please? I'm telling you, this is great. He'll do it for nothing. But he's got to get paid, because he's got a family and you got to pay him. So I finally got Paramount to agree. And what I said to Bob was, look, they're not paying you that much anyway. This has got to be great. We can't show it to anybody until it's great. So I know that, you're supposed to turn it in 12 weeks and, you've got a thing. I said, I'll make sure that you don't have to turn it in until we both agree that it's good. And I'll let you do whatever you want to make other money so that we don't have to turn it in so you can take something else. So it took a year more. And he would write a draft. He's a very fast writer. He would write a draft, and I'd go, it's not good. He would write another draft. He must have written 10 drafts. But more importantly, it would be like, we find Saving Private Ryan on page 30, and the movie is about the journey back. They get to Ryan. Ryan's dead. I mean, we had all these different versions of the movie, and we kept going, man, that's not it. No, that's not right. We could still use some of the material in between. And finally, we had a draft that we were mostly good with. And so we turned it into Paramount, and they said, that's pretty good. I said, it's great. And they said, well, it's pretty good. I said, well, you going to make it? Well, we don't know. And I didn't have a lot of money at the time. And I said, I'll buy it back from you. And they said, no, we don't need the money. We'll, if you can put the movie together in an interesting way, we'll consider it. So I'm on the phone. It's like, nothing's happening. And I get a call from Richard Lovett, who is the head of CAA now, was an agent at CAA at the time. And I think he was the head of the agency back then. It's been a while. And he goes, look, Tom Hanks read the script. I had actually called him, and another agent over there had called, and he likes the script. Would you meet with him? But you can't tell anybody. Now, this was when Tom Hanks was the biggest star in the world. I said, okay. So I go have lunch with Tom. He's very excited about it. He says, would you mind if I gave it to Steven Spielberg? I said, no, I wouldn't mind.
No, you wouldn't. Steven who?
Well, okay, if you must.
What's he done?
Exactly. So he said, I'm going to give it to Steven. I think he'd really like this movie. So he gives it to Steven. I get a call. Now I'm still not allowed to tell anybody at Paramount. I get a call. Steven wants to do it. The same day, I get a call from Paramount. Great news. This director wants to do it.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
And I said, they said, we want to get into a deal with him right away. And I can tell you that, let me put it to you this way. If you've ever heard of this director, you sure as hell haven't heard of his name in 20 minutes, in 20 years, or however long it's been. I said, don't do that. And they said, why not? I said, I can't tell you, but just believe me when I tell you I can do better. And then, of course, you know, you tell somebody that, it's like saying, I'm not going to tell you the secret. They're like, what is it? 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 And I'm thinking, I can't blow this. I said I wouldn't tell, and I'm not going to tell because I know how things go. So I don't tell. Finally, it all comes out. And what I really want to say to the people at Paramount is, hey, fuckers, you wouldn't believe in this script. And look what I did without your help. Of course, then I had to call the other director and his agent because he was a friend of mine as well. And I had to say, look, I'm really sorry. I know you wanted to do this. And I know we were having, you know, initial conversations, but Steven Spielberg wants to do the movie, and I hope you understand that I picked him. And the guy was very gracious. He said, I understand. And his agent was, I get it, you know, but it was, I felt bad about it. And that's how that movie ended up getting made.
Well, hopefully they got Bob Rodat got a little bit more for his effort.
Yeah, he got paid because they made the movie. So ultimately he did get paid, and he also was nominated for an Academy Award.
So, okay. So let's go. So that's the process of development. Let's go that the production of that movie, especially the beach scene, is so iconic. The storming of Normandy is unbelievable. Were you there when they were shooting that?
I wasn't, not because I couldn't be or didn't want to be. But I believe at the time my wife was having a baby and I couldn't leave.
But you're seeing the dailies?
I'd like to interject something. My uncle Homer, my dad's brother, landed at Normandy and he was speechless during the film.
Well, interesting about the movie is that, you know, people will say, well, was that in the script? And I say, yeah, 2 pages of it. You can't write 20 pages of an action scene in a script. But I will tell you that the first time I met Steven, I don't know where he was, but it was myself and Tom and Bob, and we drove to Steven's house. And this is when, you know, there was no Zoom, there was none of that, but Steven had one of those things in his house where you could talk to each other. It wasn't very good quality. But we had a meeting. He was in New York or Europe or I don't know where he was. But what he said was, he said, let me tell you something. When I shoot that beach scene, people are going to think that they were there. He said, people will not have ever seen anything like what I'm going to do in that opening sequence. And let me tell you,
How long did it take to shoot that whole beach scene?
Not very long, considering how long it is on the screen and how difficult it was.
Amazing.
I mean, the thing about this man is that you watch him work, he is a savant. I mean, whether you like all of his movies or some of his movies, he is a master like I've never seen before. And I've worked with some very impressive directors over the years. He doesn't have to prepare the way other directors prepare. He has it in his head.
Is he bringing a shot list?
I never saw one. I'm sure he had.
All right, but it's in his head.
But he's like, he knows what he wants. He knows what he's doing. He works with the same people. It was an interesting experience for me because I had spent a year where it was just me and Bob. And we were making the movie over and over and over again on the page. And then when Steven came in, it was like, thank you. But I'm going to go off and make the movie. You're welcome to come and visit. But he didn't need me. And, you know, I got it. There were no expectations. I didn't think I would be saying, oh, maybe you should move the camera over here, or I don't think you have it, Steven.
Or the fire's not big enough.
Yeah, the fire's not big enough, exactly. And so, you know, I made the choice to not go and stand around like a tourist, because I had other movies that I was making and I had other work to do. But I did visit a couple times, and he was lovely and he was gracious. It was an incredible experience. And then, of course, I got to know him a little bit. And we haven't made another movie since then, but he has been a friend personally and otherwise. And we have worked on a couple of things that ultimately didn't get made. He's a master.
Well, not only is he a master, Ian Bryce, who was a co-producer on that movie.
He was
a producer on the movie. I remember at one of your parties, I was talking to him, and they were doing Saving Private Ryan. And I asked him about the experience. And he said to me, Steven Spielberg is amazing that if he says, you know what would be great tomorrow? If we had a cloudy day.
Yeah, right.
And the next day it's a cloudy day. Well, or he would say, you know what would be good? I want to get this shot at the cemetery. It would be great if we could find a tombstone that said Private Ryan on it. And they found it.
Well, and Ian and I had done two other movies prior to the time that he came on Saving Private Ryan. We did Speed. He was the line producer on Speed, and then he was the line producer on another Graham Yost movie, the third Graham Yost movie that I did, called Hard Rain, which nobody really saw, but was an interesting experience. And I think, Ken, you and I talked about it a little bit. But again, just to go back to Saving Private Ryan, it was even Steven who, you know, knew that he had made a wonderful film, and we all saw the film, and it was fantastic. I don't think anybody really had the idea that it would have such a profound effect on men who had been in the military.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, excuse me, specifically the Second World War, but anybody in battle. I have been very lucky over the years to have been involved in some movies and television experiences that became cultural phenomenons. Saving Private Ryan was one. And it changed the way people in the service were able to talk to their families and friends about war, because it was the first time that they felt that in some way war, particularly the Second World War and the Normandy invasion, was depicted in a way that was so horrific and visceral that they could feel like they had something that they could use to talk about it.
What my uncle said was it was almost the stylistic aspect of the deafening, the lack of sound.
The sound, yeah.
That was the most realistic to him.
Yeah.
Is all this stuff is going on, it's massively, you know, explosions, but you
like
almost become deaf. All you see is what's happening. And he said that was the most realistic part of the beach
sound
scene.
Sound design was amazing. It was amazing. And that movie, just that section of the movie is worthy of a whole conversation on its own. And it was all Steven. I mean, it was just that whole experience was a pure filmmaking.
But that was, and not to belabor it, but that was inspired because Steven wasn't a soldier. He didn't land at Normandy. But to understand that this is going to shut off your senses, this experience, that's what a lot of soldiers related to.
Yeah, and he did it, and he does his homework. You know, he really does his homework. I mean, he is, again, you like his movies or you like some of his movies or you don't like a movie that he's made in a while. The man is not a human being. He's a he's a movie god. He's just amazing.
Yeah. And did he win the Academy Award for directing?
He did. I didn't.
Yeah, I know. Which was my point. Which is where I was going.
Yeah. Well, it was very disturbing, especially because, you know, Saving Private Ryan and Shakespeare in Love, I started to stand up because, I mean, of course we were going to win. It was very depressing. I have to say that it was so painful at the moment. My heart was broken.
You're not the first person to get fucked by Harvey Weinstein, apparently, because that's who you lost to.
I like that. I like that. I don't know what you mean, but I like the way you're saying it.
That was the first time where they were talking about Harvey Weinstein was able to lobby based on the amount of money he would spend promoting Shakespeare in Love to the industry. And doing that, he was able to buy the award. Is that possible? Is that really accurate? Is that people will be swayed by advertisements?
So here's how it works. The Academy is made up, as you know, of different disciplines. Directors of photography, costume designers, production designers, all the different, I think there are like 25 different categories for the Academy. But by far the largest are the actors. And there is a, if you look at historically the Academy Awards, many, many times, best pictures have been won by movies that really were actor movies. Shakespeare in Love was the ultimate actor movie. And so what Harvey did was he would throw these parties. He would throw these parties for old actors. I mean, it's a little bit like the Hollywood Foreign Press. You have a movie, you invite them, you wine them, you dine them. It's like a junket almost, where if you're promoting, when we were opening Murder on the Orient Express, we took all these reporters on the Orient Express. I mean, it cost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. I mean, I don't know what it cost, but it was a fortune. But you create this thing, and they spent a fortune wining and dining all these people, particularly the actors. And so did he buy it? What happened was that the level of money that he spent was crazy. And after that, there was a real tension with how much money people should spend and whether you could do this or whether you could do that and what you could and couldn't do. As far as promoting your picture to the Motion Picture Academy, to the members. So, yeah, he was aggressive, and he bought it.
All right, moving off of this one. Here's a movie that Mark made in 2004, and right now is probably so incredibly relevant, which is The Day After Tomorrow.
You know, again, I give all the credit to the director. Roland Emmerich had this idea, and he had written a script himself, and it wasn't great, and he knew it. And he brought it to me and said, look, I love this story. I've got this script. What do we do?
And But was it driven by a real thing? Like Al Gore back in the day was talking about climate change. Nobody was talking about climate change then.
They were, but it wasn't.
He had had it before Al Gore became. Here's the thing about Roland. If you look at his movies, he is very ahead of the curve when it comes to, you know, he made Independence Day. He made 2012. He made The Day After Tomorrow. He's a zeitgeisty guy. I hate that word, but he is. He really is a guy who's very tuned in. And he was really interested in it. And the other thing about Roland is that he's a very, very intelligent, sophisticated guy. He's one of the most well-read people I know. Now, his movies are not particularly sophisticated. They're pop movies. But the ideas behind them are very thoughtful, and he's always trying to make things that are interesting and curious questions about the world put into a very, what he would say, is a Spielbergian world, which is, you know, I don't want to say the lowest common denominator, but, Anyway, the point is, he brought me the script. I said, yeah, you're right. The script isn't great. Let's hire another writer to rewrite and reinvent your script. I brought in a writer who I knew, who I had done some work with, Jeffrey Nachmanoff, and the three of us talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and developed the script that Jeffrey wrote and Roland wrote-ish. And then we went out to the town with it, and everybody in town wanted to make it. And it was one of these great situations where we had a script, we knew what the movie was going to cost, and we said, okay, who wants it? If you want this, this is what it's going to cost. This is how much you have to pay us, and you're not allowed to give any script notes. You have to accept the script as it is, which, by the way, was fantastic because they didn't have a contractual right to give notes. The notes that they gave us were fantastic, but they didn't give us 9,000 stupid notes, which people feel the necessity or obligation to do.
But you were leveraging coming off of Saving Private Ryan and all your other successes.
It wasn't about me. It was about Independence Day and Fox, and it was about The Patriot, which wasn't as big a hit. But it was, you know, that was a pure Roland movie, and nobody makes those movies better than he does.
Although his titles, I don't love.
You don't like
The Day After Tomorrow?
I don't understand.
Why couldn't it have been A Week from Thursday?
It could have been, except that would have been a movie that Shecky Green was in.
Okay, so then let me ask you another question. Now that we look at his other movie, 2012, doesn't it seem a little dated in 2020?
It did, but it made him almost $1 billion. So
you said in the beginning it's not about the money.
It isn't, but unless it is.
Unless it is. Unless it is.
Can I interrupt with a question?
Sure.
And it's completely different than what we've been talking about. All right. And we can come back to this.
Sure.
But I got to ask you a question, because you went to NYU with Ken.
That's how I met.
I'm in college at Northwestern Film School, same time.
Yep.
Tuition, room and board was about $14,000 total, everything. Now tuition alone at NYU Northwestern is $50,000.
Yeah.
Room and board, it's 80 grand or 90 or 100 to go to college per year.
It's insane.
My son wants to be an actor. He went to the Academy, $50,000 a year. Well, given that it's so expensive to go to college, and at the time, the basic paradigm was to study film theory, craft, and the people that we got to know studying film theory and craft became the nucleus of those people that we worked together and started our careers.
Right.
You know, I'm happy to say that Brad Hall, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, those were my people, and we formed careers. But my entire bill was $70,000 when I graduated. Paid it off in a year.
Right.
What would you say to someone now looking at film school or a liberal arts school? Do you spend $200,000 or do you start making YouTube videos?
Well, what I would say is that putting aside the cost, because not all schools are you know, you can go to a state school, and there's some great ones, depending upon what state you live in. And by the way, as we know, the thing that affects us more than anything, it's not the institution, it's the individual teacher that you have that either inspires you or teaches you or makes you feel like anything is possible. So let's just put the cost aside. I do not recommend film school to people. And the reason that I don't recommend film school to people is because I think to a large extent, what film school, the thing that's important in any kind of movies or television is, what are you telling a story about? What life experience do you have? What have you read? Do you know history? Do you know English? Have you read great plays? Have you, you know, and the thing about film school is that unless those things are also interesting to you, you know, you have a year's worth of liberal arts to get rid of your math and science and whatever your requirements are for that particular major. And then everything else is film. So what are you learning? You're learning how to make films, but you're not learning about life. You're not learning about art. You're not learning about history. And these are all things that are the things that you tell stories about. And that's what being a filmmaker is a storyteller.
No, you're absolutely right. The thing that I would say for me, and that's to you as well, I think to a certain extent, I had no relationships in the film business when I wanted to get into the business. NYU did offer me friendships, you obviously, and other people, that as we all kind of went out, having that connection did help us kind of...
I agree. I'm not saying...
Those relationships did help keep me in the business.
Yes, but I think...
Renee got me my job at MTV. Renee was my friend at NYU.
I know, but you would have found your way. What I would say is that too many people come out of film school, and there was a whole sort of years and years of it where so many of these films were like all visual and no substance. And they were all about, people were telling stories about things that maybe people didn't care about, or it was style over substance. So again, I had a very good experience in film school because I didn't know anything, and it was good for me to learn basics. And I also spent a year at Boston University doing most of my liberal arts credits, took a year off, and then went back and finished NYU in 2 years. So I really got through college in 3 years because I wanted to work. Did I learn things in, you know what I learned in film school? The appreciation of cinema. The technical aspects and the practical aspects, you know, you learn more as a production assistant, you know, in 3 weeks on a TV commercial than you do in film school. But unless you're, you know, unless, I don't know, that was me. Everybody has a different experience.
Well, yeah, but know, today, go ahead, Gary, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I'm looking at my son and his friends, and they're doing TikTok videos and they're doing YouTube videos.
Right.
You know, I'm looking at they have applications to edit their own films, sound and score. The camera they've got is actually terrific. Yeah. You know, it's 4-chip. And so they're making movies and they're telling stories. They're disposable in a sense, but they're doing it. And I feel like they're learning craft, and I feel like they're learning to tell stories because they make so many of them so quickly. Their trial and error is like the Beatles in Hamburg. They're failing in real time.
Yep.
And learning their craft. So I'm just kind of feeling, if I'm going to spend $200,000, I just as soon give it to the kid. Go make movies, kid, with your friends.
I agree with you. But what I would say is, just to go back, but make sure that from an educational point of view, he's reading books.
Exactly.
He's reading the classics. He's studying Shakespeare. He's going to the theater. He's looking at films that were made before 1990. You know, right. For him, that's an old movie.
But that's way, exactly. And I don't
we
even.
There were none of this. We didn't have any. There were no phones. There were no.
No.
We you know, it didn't exist. There were no cell phones back then.
There were no ATMs when I was in college.
I had an outhouse in the backyard. We had no plumbing.
We used the Sears catalog as toilet paper.
Exactly.
Important question to me, and thank you for that answer. I appreciate it.
I think it's a good question.
Does the name of the college on somebody's resume mean anything to you?
No.
Me either.
Not even a little bit. You know, I did have people in my company who were like, oh, they went to Harvard. Who gives a shit? You know, I barely look at a resume, because especially if you're hiring somebody as an assistant in an entry-level position, which is when you have a resume, so to speak, it's like I look at it really to see if they've worked with anybody that I know. But otherwise, it's like, who are you? What are you interested in? And are you interesting to me? And do I want to spend, you know, 10 hours a day with you locked up in an office? Are you going to make me laugh? Are you smart? Are you funny? Are you going to challenge me? Are you going to read scripts and give me good thoughts? Are you going to, you know, be good to hang around with? And, you know, look, people will say, well, why do you think you were successful in the movie business? I worked my ass off. I'm reasonably intelligent. I've got a good sense of story. I learned and I worked hard and I put in my 10,000 times 10 hours. But it's because I refused to say die. And by the way, there are plenty of people who can fulfill the same things, requirements that I just said, who didn't get lucky either, because all of that, and you still need to get lucky.
Well, I'm going to throw this out.
I'm not the only one who says this. Hard work is more valuable than talent in certain things. Look, if you're a writer, you got to be able to write. But there are plenty of mediocre directors who just really wanted it badly enough. There are plenty of producers who don't have – they just work hard. They outwork people.
I'm going to say, and this is just going to sound like, you know, I guess a bunch of old people going way back when, but the reason I got into this business, and I think the reason that you got into this business, and probably Gary too, is because we all got a passion for the business.
Yeah.
And the reason we got that passion is because we sat in a movie theater in anticipation of the lights coming down and the curtain opening and us getting swept into this story and falling in love with that. That experience right now is not available.
Well, that's true.
And I don't know where you're going to get that passion. Are you going to get that passion for making a movie or storytelling, that same experience because you're binge watching on Netflix? Are you going to get that same passion for the love of it if you're making YouTube videos? Okay.
I think you can, and I'll tell you why. Because when we were younger, we had movies and we had three networks,
ABC,
CBS, and NBC. And the reason it was called broadcasting was because it was a net for a broad audience. And so everything in television was almost exclusively for middle America that would reach and when I say the lowest common denominator, I don't mean stupid people. I just mean as many people as possible. Okay. And when we went to see a movie, and I grew up in Newport News, Virginia, we didn't have art films. We didn't, you know, you grew up in Iowa. Promise you there were not a lot of art cinemas there. You weren't seeing Godard as a, you know, 14-year-old. So we were watching, you know,
Fritz the Cat. That's what I was going to.
Bond movies and
I am curious,
Iron Man, Flint, and the Disney movies, but we weren't seeing high art or particularly sophisticated
work. But it was escapist. It was going into a whole new world.
But that, my point is that what's different, we're not sitting in a movie theater where the curtain comes up, but young people are now seeing stories because they don't need as big an audience to narrow cast programming to people that is much more sophisticated intellectually, emotionally, speaking to those young people and telling stories that they can really relate to. So it's not the same, but it's different. And I would argue that it's neither better or worse. It's just different.
Right.
Is this the end of the Cineplex? We'll get Mark's answer to that question. The future of television? the making of the film Steve Jobs, working with Aaron Sorkin, and what's Patrick Dempsey really like? As a matter of fact, the conversation went on so long, I had to leave because of a family commitment. So I'm curious to hear this show myself. Stay tuned for more of our conversation with film and television producer Mark Gordon. And please, tell your friends. Thanks for all your support.